It is sometimes believed that Old Testament religion is external, while the New Testament focuses on the internal. The Old Testament is about outward actions and liturgies, whereas the New Testament, well, that's about the heart and sincerity. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. The religion of the Old Testament is the same as the religion of the New Testament, and both focus on the heart. Both are concerned about the inward, about our sincerity, and about our hearts. And we see that to be the case with the 10th commandment, which does address our hearts. And in particular, it regulates our desires, our affections, our cravings, our appetites. And here we see that God is not just concerned about what we say and about what we do, but he's also concerned about what goes on in our minds and in our hearts. He's concerned about what we think about what we set our heart upon, about what we cherish, about what we want. Deuteronomy 6 famously says that we are to love God with all our heart and with all our soul and with all our might. In other words, we are to worship God, to serve God with all that is, with our whole being, with every part of us is to serve God. And so, of course, God's law is going to address every part of us, including our hearts and our desires. And that's what the 10th commandment focuses on. It focuses on the desires of our hearts. And so that's where we're going to begin this morning, the desires of our hearts. And we are creatures of desire. We dream, we wish, we have appetites and affections, even very strong ones. And God has made us this way. This is who we are. To desire is human. And that is why desires make us tick. We are motivated and stirred to action by what we want, by what we want to pursue. You've heard the saying that money makes the world go round. Well, it seems to me that we could say that desires make human beings go round. One theologian said that desire is the combustible power that moves human life. Desire is the combustible power that moves human life. And he's right. I mean, think about it. Why do we do what we do? For example, why do we go out and make money? Why do we work to make money? Because we want to provide for our families, or maybe buy fancy stuff, or become richer than other people, or so that people will look up to us, or so that we won't be destitute and suffer, or for some other goal that we want to pursue. Why did Eve take and eat the forbidden fruit? Genesis 3:6 says that she did it when she saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. Eve was motivated to take it because she found it attractive and wanted what it promised to give her. Now, Satan certainly deceived her in all these things, but Satan knew what he was doing when he appealed to the desires of her heart. James says that each person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. See, desires drive us to do what we do. But we shouldn't let the example of Eve or the passage from James lead us to think that desires in and of themselves are sinful, or that our problem is that we have desires, and they are the things that lead us to sin against God. So that if we could just get rid of our desires, if we could just have no desires whatsoever, then everything would be okay. We wouldn't sin, and we would be perfect. No, that's not the case at all. We aren't Buddhists, after all. We are Christians. But more than that, we are human beings. And the Bible doesn't teach us that desires are wrong or sinful per se. In fact, it's just the opposite. Indeed, God appeals to our heart's desires to motivate us to trust and obey him and to follow him. We've even seen that in the Ten Commandments. You want to keep the second commandment because God will visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation of those who hate him. You want to keep the second commandment because he will show steadfast love to thousands of those who love him and keep his commandments. You want to keep the fifth commandment because God promises a long and prosperous life to those who honor their parents. It's appealing to your desire. Jesus does the same thing in the New Testament. Store up treasures for yourselves, he says, because those are the treasures that are going to last, the ones that you will be able to keep forever, not ones that are just going to be here for a time and gone forever. Build your house on the rock and not on the sand, he says, so that you will be able to endure the coming judgment. Well, the same is true, of course, with the gospel offer. The Bible connects the invitation or the command to believe in Jesus with the why you would want to believe in Jesus. Why would you want to believe in Jesus? So that you don't perish, but you receive eternal life. You see, God is saying this is something you ought to desire. You should want this. Desire it and go and get it by believing in Jesus. So it's not wrong to be moved by desire. God made us this way, and so he motivates us this way. And that is why the 10th commandment does not simply or merely say, you shall not covet. Now, although the word in English, covet, carries a negative meaning and therefore refers to something that's bad, that we don't want to do, the Hebrew word simply refers to desire. And God here is not saying that you shall not desire. Rather, he's saying that there are some desires that you should not have, that there are some desires that are forbidden. That's why there are objects attached to the verb. He doesn't just say, you shall not covet, but rather, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or house or field or anything that is your neighbor's. And so the point, then, is that you must not desire something that belongs to someone else. Or more generally, you're not to desire that which is sinful. In other words, you must not set your heart on the wrong objects. That's the point of the commandment. Eve shouldn't have desired the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil because that fruit did not belong to her. God had given her fruit from every other tree in the garden. She was free to desire all those fruits, except for the fruit of this one tree. She shouldn't have desired or wanted that one. David was free and ought to have desired and delighted in Abigail, the wife that God had given to him. But he had no right to want to sleep with Bathsheba, who was Uriah's wife. And so when we use the word, the English word covet, in a negative sense, we are simply using it to capture the meaning of the commandment and not the word covet itself, or at least the Hebrew word that's translated as covet. When we say covet, then, we are in a negative sense, we are using it to refer to an illicit desire, but not desire altogether. Now, it's important to understand that as we consider this commandment, that it's not talking about wanting things that you don't presently have or would like to enjoy. It's right, it's good, it's natural to desire something and then to go and do your best to get what you want. Of course, assuming that what you want is good for you to have and to enjoy. It's often noted that the opposite of coveting is being content. And when we think about being content, we often think about being satisfied with what we have. And so we might think that if we want what we don't have, then we're being discontent, we are coveting, we're breaking the 10th commandment. Well, that's not true at all. It's not wrong to want to get married when you're not married and when you haven't even met someone that you would like to marry. It's not wrong to want a house when you don't have a house. It's not wrong to then go and work hard so that you can build that house that you would like to have. It's not wrong to want to have food and drink when you don't have any food and drink. Right? To desire is human. So again, there's nothing wrong with wanting something that you like to have and going out and doing your best to go out and get it. That is not coveting. That's just being human. And so it's not wrong to go to your neighbor's house and think, man, wow, what a beautiful house. I would like to have a house just like that. Or to look at his car and say, man, what a nice car. I would love to have a car like that. Now, it would be wrong, of course, to go to your neighbor's house and say, I want your house. That's the house I want, and I want to take it from you. That's coveting. Or to take his car. But that's not the same thing as wanting to have a house like his house or to have a car like his car. There's a world of difference between those two things. And the Bible encourages us to go and satisfy our desires, if they are good desires, to work so that we might eat and drink and build a house, buy a car, and so on. Now, what about when our desires go unsatisfied, or when our dreams that we pursue don't come true? Because, and this is a spoiler alert, and believe it or not, that actually happens in this world, that dreams don't always come true. I mean, what if you want to get married, but for some reason you never do? What if you want to stay married, but you end up getting divorced? What if you want to have children, but for some reason you can't have children? What if you want to buy that nice house and you work hard to get it, but then somebody comes along and steals all of your money so that you can't build that dream house? Would it be okay in that instance to be filled with sorrow or to be deeply, deeply disappointed? Or would that be wrong? Would that be coveting? Would that be being discontent in a sinful way? Well, no, it wouldn't be. It's totally fine and normal and human to be deeply disappointed and filled with sorrow in those types of situations. Proverbs says that hope deferred makes the heart sick. We aren't stoics. God has made us to have hopes and dreams and desires, and it's terrible. It's hard when those dreams are crushed by sinners or by this sinful, fallen world. And we shouldn't pretend otherwise. I mean, think of Hannah. She was absolutely devastated when she couldn't have any children. And she just poured out her heart to the Lord in prayer. She wasn't coveting or being sinfully discontent. You shall not covet doesn't mean that you shouldn't want something that you don't have or that you can't be sad or disappointed when your dreams don't come true. It does mean, though, that we shouldn't let our desires and dreams become idols. They shouldn't take the place of God in our life so that we are willing to do whatever it takes to make our dreams come true, or that we're going to drown in grief when they don't, because now we have nothing left to live for. We have always something to live for, don't we? And the greatest thing to live for is Christ himself. Our chief end is not our house that we want to build. Our chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And that always remains true. And so if our desires or dreams take the place of God, that would then be to desire something sinful. That would be to worship an idol. And that, of course, would be then to break the 10th commandment. Now, we might be tempted to think that since coveting takes place in the heart, it's a desire, it really can't be all that bad. I mean, after all, to want to kill someone and actually killing someone is very different, and the latter is much worse. Clearly, that is true. But that doesn't mean that coveting isn't a serious sin, because it is, and the Bible treats it as such. I mean, Paul equates covetousness with idolatry, and idolatry is no peccadillo. Jesus warns us to take care and be on our guard against all covetousness. When Paul writes his list of sins that characterize the ungodly in Romans chapter 1, he does include covetousness. He also says in Colossians that on account of covetousness, among other sins, that the wrath of God is coming. He also says that the one who is covetous has no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. And one reason coveting is so serious is because of what it produces, what it leads to. Packer says that coveting is the root of all social evil. Desires that burst the bounds beget actions to match. We understand that, don't we? I mean, coveting can lead to hatching a plan to get what you are coveting, and then that can then lead to actually carrying out your plan and sinning outwardly. Inward sin leads to outward sin. That's the way it works. That's what happened with David, with Achan, and Judas. James says, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. Right? Sin doesn't come from nowhere. It just doesn't just happen out of the blue. All sin starts in the heart, and it comes from the heart. Which is why, of course, the command not to covet is very well placed at the end of the Ten Commandments, because it really does serve as an appropriate summary of all the other commandments. Because you can break all other nine in your heart, which is itself a violation of the tenth. Now, like the other nine, we break this commandment too. But as Christians, we've been set free from the dominion of sin, and we are called to put this sin to death by the Spirit. And so the question is, as Christians, how are we going to do that? Well, we don't do it by trying to extinguish or suppress desire itself. Right? Remember, the problem is not desire, but sinful desires, disordered or perverted desires. And so our task then is to extinguish those ones. That's what we want to do. But we can't do that just by wishing them away. We do need to work at it. We need to work at renewing our minds and our hearts, which will then lead to having new desires. But we do that, first of all, by resisting our evil desires. So when they do come, and when we feel them and think about them, we need to resist them, not feed them, not indulge them, but work at resisting them and putting them to death. Which leads us to the second thing that we need to do, and is that we need to learn to redirect or reorient our desires. Right? We don't want to be stoics or passionless, but rather we want to, by renewing our minds with the Word of God, to cultivate new desires, to learn to treasure what is good and right and beautiful, to set our minds and hearts on those things. Right? This is the put off and the put off principle that Paul refers to in Ephesians 4. We stop lying by starting to tell the truth. The thief stops stealing and then begins to work with his hands, honest work, so he can give to those in need. We want to stop desiring evil and do that by replacing it with desiring that which is good. And to help us to do that, we ought to learn to see what sinful desire is and what sin will do to us. We want to learn to see that sin is not as attractive as it really is, because sin is attractive. You will find it attractive. That's why you'll be drawn to it, why you will want to do it. It will seduce you by its beauty and by what it promises to give you, the pleasure it promises to give you. And we need to be aware that that's going on. And we need to be able to learn to see past the beautiful veneer of sin to see what it really is and what it really is going to do to us. Right? We need to see that though we might find pleasure in the moment, engaging in sin won't be worth it in the end. We will regret it and we will suffer for it. And so the more that we're able to see the ugliness of sin, the less attracted to it we will be, the less we will desire it, and the easier it will be to resist it. And this is what Proverbs 9 teaches us to do. There you have both Lady Wisdom and Lady Folly. And they're both calling out to the young man, to all of us, to come and dine with them at their table. Both are appealing to our hearts. They're both pulling on our heartstrings, our desires. Both of them present themselves to us as being attractive and beautiful, something that you want. But only one of them actually leads to life. Only one of them can actually deliver what it promises to give you. And that is Lady Wisdom, which is the way of trust and obedience to God. Now, Lady Folly, or sin, will promise the world. And you may think in the moment that she's able to give it to you. But no matter how long the fleeting pleasures of sin are, they are just that. They are fleeting. Whatever pleasure you have, it will eventually turn to anguish, because it's not going to last and it's going to end in death. In verse 18 of Proverbs 9, we learn that if you go in and dine at the table of Lady Folly, you will soon discover who is at her table. It's the dead. And that her feast, her banquet, is in Sheol, or the grave. And that's not where you want to end up. So don't go down that road. Choose Lady Wisdom. We need to see what sin's going to do to us. And we need to see how ugly it is. And let that make us be repulsed by it, so that we don't go down that road. See, sin loses its luster in the light of what it will actually do to you. So let's consider a concrete example in putting these things together. We are coveting our neighbor's goods, his talents, or his abilities, something like that. What are we going to do? Well, we should acknowledge what we are doing is sinful and seek God's forgiveness, and ask God to give us the strength to put our covetous desires to death. We should see also that envying our neighbor will make life miserable for ourselves. It will make us bitter and unable to enjoy the things that God has given us. It will make our present life unbearable even. So we should see the ugliness and the destructive consequences of envy and how it ruins everything. We should also think about what we ought to want in this situation. Instead of wanting what our neighbor has, we should think about what ought we to want. I mean, our heart is going to attach itself to something. What should it attach itself to? What would be a good desire to replace this evil desire? Well, one good desire would be the well-being of your neighbor. We should rejoice with those who rejoice. We should want our neighbor to do well, to prosper, to be well. We should take great delight that God is blessing them and using them for the good of others and for the glory of God. We might also take stock of the blessings that God has given to us and give thanks to God for them. Still further, we might look at our neighbor and learn from him. Maybe seek to imitate him so that we might be able to do what he does or to have what he has, to grow and learn from the things that he's able to do. You see, we don't put coveting to death by suppressing desire, but by redirecting our desires to the right objects. But the law, of course, by itself can't do that. The bare command, you shall not covet, is not going to change your heart so that you can redirect your desires, so you can see the truth and be able to obey the truth and desire the truth. Only the Spirit of Christ, of course, can do that. And he does do that by using the Word of God, including the commandments, to sanctify us. He is, even now, writing his law on our hearts so that we will be careful more and more to keep this commandment and to enjoy the benefits that flow from that. But that, of course, does not mean that we don't have to work at it. Growing in grace and in holiness is like being a soldier, an athlete. It takes work. Putting sin to death is a process, and it takes effort. And it's something that we need to do. You see, being a Christian doesn't mean that we are now free to covet all that we want with impunity. That's not it at all. Being a Christian means that we are free to pursue holiness now, without which no one will see the Lord. Well, Jesus said that where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. As human beings, we pursue what we find desirable. We set our hearts on what we consider to be a treasure. But that does not mean that we have a right to desire anything we want or to just follow our heart and be authentic in that sense. That's not being authentic at all. That's just being a sinner. No, God is God, and he, not our hearts, and certainly not our sinful hearts, regulates and governs what we should or should not desire and therefore pursue. And he tells us that we must not covet. That is, we must not desire anything that belongs to someone else or anything that is sinful. Let us pray.